A very warm welcome to this part of the Destinations Travel Show. How many here have seen Mr. Reeve on the telly? How many saw him in the Caribbean? How many saw him in Ireland? How many saw him on a beach somewhere and they can't quite remember where it was? Excellent, we've all come to the right place. Simon, you were here, in fact, you and I were here on these very chairs this time last year.
Yes.
When you were telling me about a forthcoming show set in the Caribbean, some of it on tropical beaches, but largely in the grittier places. How was it received? Well, tell us what you were doing, for those that don't know, and then tell us how it was received.
Well, we've got a visual aid here, haven't we?
We have.
So it's a pity our image is blocking it slightly. Well, the idea with the series was travel around the Caribbean Sea. Use the magnificent brand, almost, that is the
that
Caribbean.
Was
that was good. It was dramatic. People like that. Wakes us all up. Travel around the Caribbean Sea, some of the islands, and then up the mainland coast of South America and Central America, the Caribbean coast, and finish the journey in Jamaica. But using the idea of mixing light with shade. So the glorious bits of the Caribbean, but also some of the more troubled parts as well. I think a reflection, I would claim, that life isn't always magnificently glorious. There's a lot of darkness out there that we try and incorporate into the programs. I say a lot of darkness. There is darkness out there, let's put it that way. One of my big travel beliefs, as it were, is that the world is a much more safe and welcoming place than many people realize. But making telly, obviously, we've got to go to some of the tricky spots.
And how did you pick the tricky? Is it you that picks the tricky spots? So, for example, you were in a prison, if memory serves, full of gangsters, protected only by the local bishop. Was that?
I later claimed. I think I can't remember whose idea that was, but I do remember having a minor bicker with one of my colleagues because we both thought we'd suggested it. But I do have the world's worst memory, so I have to trust. I think actually two people said they thought of it first. If it had gone badly wrong, obviously everybody would have denied it.
Yeah, exactly.
But we got out okay. It was all right. But no, you're talking about we went to a prison in Honduras that
That's
was run by the inmates. It was a completely otherworldly place to go to. Very strange, as you can probably imagine. Was it my idea, or do I get involved in all the minute detail? Probably not the minute detail. But I am involved at almost every stage in the process. It was my idea. I mean, I know it's not rocket science, but
sure.
I felt that it was an area that could be encapsulated in a simple single idea, journey around the Caribbean Sea. I thought that there was light and shade there that would make for an interesting few TV programs. And then we sit down and we try and work out and argue about what we could do to try and get a sort of balance of issues and stories and a bit of history and obviously some interesting characters as well in the programmes.
Let's have a quick pop, because there are so many
you
of you.
You like your polls, don't
well,
you?
Well, because they've come here to see you, but they also want to be engaged, and I think it's right and fair that we get to hear
get
from
them.
Get
them doing some exercises.
As much as they get to hear us. How many here watch Simon's shows for ideas of where to go on holiday alone? Just thinking, where's Simon gone that looks interesting?
There
nobody.
A couple of hands. Couple
One
of hands.
Person at the back. How many here watch Simon's shows to think, I want to know more about this place that I might be thinking about going on holiday? What's behind the tourism? What's behind the tourism?
Little hands.
How many just, well done, how many just want pretty pictures on their telly while they're having something to eat? Well, thank you. I probably shan't be asking you any more questions for the rest of the day. So what have you been doing since Caribbean? Since we saw you a year ago, Caribbean was screened. You've obviously done a couple other shows since then. Where have you been?
Yes, I did a couple of programs about Ireland, and I've done a couple of programs about Greece, and the Greece mini-series is going out this weekend, actually, entirely coincidentally.
We'll talk about Greece in a minute. Just come to Ireland, first of all, because it's closer. What were you doing there? What was the
Traveling
idea?
Around. That's what I do, Paul.
Tony Hawk's dealing with a fridge. What did you take?
I've just discovered he lives quite near me, actually.
Yeah.
And I've got to quiz him about this because it's a bonkers idea. He also did playing the Moldovans at tennis
which
he?
Came out of a bet with Arthur Smith.
Yeah, I think probably the fridge round Ireland did as well.
Yeah.
Okay, what was I doing? I was going on a journey around Ireland, obviously, trying to tell a few new sides to Ireland that Brits, at least, aren't aware of, while still making it into a watchable travel series. It was funded by the Religion and Ethics Department,
Of the BBC.
Of the BBC, yeah. So they're the ones who signed the cheque to pay for it.
Okay.
So it was, we approached it through a prism of religion and faith, partly because Ireland was, until very recently, the most Catholic country in the world. Extraordinary thing, really. And now, a generation later, it's a country that, of course, has voted by popular vote for gay marriage. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
So an enormous cultural shift. And although there are still areas there where there's quite conservative views and where some traditional beliefs, should we say, the country has changed overwhelmingly. The island has changed dramatically. The north, of course, there are still pockets where people live in a way that would surprise many people in this part of the country.
In what way?
In what way? Very fair question. I didn't really explain it, did I? So I was amazed to see a 65-foot peace wall or separation barrier still up in Belfast. I mean, I think many of us who are outside the Troubles but grew up hearing about them think that, oh, you know, the peace process, everybody's put down their Kalashnikovs and all had a hug and moved on. And of course, it's not like that. And there has to be some respect and reflection on that, given that thousands of people died, for God's sake. I mean, you can't just suddenly move on from that when your loved ones, your friends have been killed by the other side in whatever form. So more peace walls have actually gone up in Belfast since the peace process than during the Troubles. Unbelievable. Still, more than 90% of children in Northern Ireland go to effectively segregated schools. So Catholic kids go to Catholic schools, Protestant schools. It doesn't bode entirely well for the future, quite frankly. But at the moment, my feeling really was that there's been a peace process, there's a management of the peace process, but there hasn't been a resolution of some of the underlying issues, the employment issues, the civil rights issues, the religious divide issues, etc., etc.
Did travelling around Ireland yourself about the Republic of Ira, what preconceptions of yours did that change?
Well, very, very early on, I mean, we only put a couple of the examples in the programme, but a number of times during the show, people said to us, I would ask a sort of slightly foolish question about the person's individual faith and belief, and it would soon come round to them saying something like, no, we don't follow the church anymore. We think for ourselves. This has been a big change here. And that was reflected by most people, I would say, in the country. I'm not saying that it's terrible to try and generalize in a sentence, but I'm not saying that the Irish as a people, particularly in the Republic, have lost their faith. But obviously, their connection with the church has taken a real hammering,
right,
largely due to the sex abuse scandals. But also, I think the Irish have become somewhat distrustful of the establishment and authority because they've been through a financial crisis. Yeah. They felt people lied to them. They felt people let them down. And then, of course, they've had the abuse scandals as well.
Great. Should we move on? How many here have been to Greece for a holiday in the last few years? How many here love Greece? How many worried about what's going on in Greece at the moment with migrants and financial disaster? We've got a bit of a treat for you. We're not meant to show you this.
No, I think it's okay.
I've
just got to get it back.
You just got to get it back. Simon's got a preview, which nobody's ever seen, of a show that launches on Sunday of a travel he's done around Greece. Would you like to see it?
I'll go on.
Complete Destinations exclusive. Even the people that were here yesterday didn't get to see it. Brian, would you like to treat us to...
It's just the start of the Greece series that I've got going out next week. We only finished it last week, to be honest. So hopefully it'll work.
Fingers crossed. Here we go. You can sit down here.
I'm on a journey around Greece, at the eastern edge of Europe, a land of mystery.
Look at that!
With fabulous islands and rugged mountains. It's one of the most beautiful and troubled countries in Europe. After years of upheaval, people here are still having a tough time.
Petrol bombs being thrown.
I'll see how Greeks are surviving and enduring.
It's the only way to travel.
In this stunning and dramatic land.
Oh my good God.
On this first leg of my journey, I'll be visiting some of Greece's glorious islands before heading to the ancient capital Athens. I'll discover how some islanders made their fortunes.
Look at them, they look disgusting.
I'll see a side to Crete that's normally hidden.
All right, so this is a traditional greeting. It's okay.
And in Athens, I come face to face with the fury of a betrayed generation.
Can we have some with the video I said? You understand this? Yes or no?
So not
very professionally done there.
Yes, thank you very much, Brian. So it's not just Simon Reeve. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So it wasn't just a trip of ouzo and sand.
There's a bit of both, right. But a fair old amount more, I would hope. Yes. I mean, I don't think you could travel to Greece at the moment without exploring the issues that you alluded to earlier, the economic crisis and, of course, the migrant refugee situation as well. But it's very strange to see it, actually, and I'm watching it there on a screen, which I haven't seen it quite like that before, because before I've only seen it when I've been in the booth with the time code on and lots of other bits on the screen as well. So it's quite weird, and I'm really critiquing it, watching it, and I'm thinking I might have got a bit carried away with the land of mystery line. That might be a bit much. I mean, I'll argue it, you know, and I've got to justify every word, but, it's justifiable. It is an extraordinary place. It is more exotic and interesting, I think, and mysterious as well than people imagine. It's interesting to see. I'm not going to watch it. I don't watch it on the telly. That would be just terribly narcissistic, but it's nice to see it.
It looks good. Okay, let's start at the beginning. When you're pitching an idea to the BBC, whichever department's going to fund it, you have to have an idea. I mean, obviously, lots of people have done Greece before. What was your pitch to them about what you can do to tell us about something about Greece that we don't already know?
Well, it's an interesting point, actually, because not that we each individual... I suppose we do, in a way. Telly people, a telly presenter, often has a sort of style that they've built up, hopefully, over a few years. So I think the style of most of the programs I've made has been to show light and shade.
Quite.
So I don't think the BBC can really justify anymore sending somebody to Greece just to do, look, here's some lovely islands. Oh, I quite fancy a drink of this ouzo. And
the time of Judith Chalmers has gone.
Well, perhaps, yes. Perhaps that's
that style.
That sort of the holiday show sort of idea is not necessarily one for the BBC to be doing now. I think that's the feeling anyway. But programs that mix and blend travel and adventure with issues, there still does seem to be an appetite for that. And thank goodness for that. I mean, obviously, I love doing it. It pays my mortgage. I love the job. I feel very blessed to do it. I do think there's a value to it. I think it's a great way of exploring quite complex issues. But if I go in to talk about a Greece series or a Caribbean series with the BBC, they know it's not going to be... let's do a tour of 5-star hotels. They know there's going to be a mixture of extremes in that.
Quite.
So the Greece, I can't remember, to be honest, who came up with the Greece idea. I think now I've been doing this so long, I've tried every idea with them. I've had the Greece idea at some point, and then eventually they say, okay, maybe now is a really good time to do it. And I think that's what happened in this case. So what we do is we sit down and we bash out a journey.
Right.
You come up with a title, because that's absolutely key. It's TV is a shallow medium which to convey information. We have to get the eyeballs of the... obviously, all of these viewers are very sophisticated, but we want to get quite a few more people watching, so we have to come up with something that sounds exotic. Then we've got to come up with a journey that feels coherent and understandable and justifiable. Often that's going around in a circle. We spent a long time deciding how we were going to do this journey, but eventually came back to what we thought of originally, which was just go around in a circle like you always do.
So the title of this one is quite uncomplicatedly Greece.
That's what it says on the tin, you know.
What did you find? We were talking about how your preconceptions of Ireland were changed by visiting there. What were your preconceptions of Greece before you went on this trip? I know you know quite a bit about it. Isn't your wife a Greekophile?
She is, and I probably claim to be the same.
Right.
Yeah, I love the place. I've spent a fair bit of time there. I've probably been to Greece more than any other place I've filmed in. But yeah, my wife is a bit bonkers about Greece, and she's half Danish, don't know why I'm telling you that. But anyway, she speaks fluent Greek and can read it.
Right.
And I'm slightly ridiculously impressed by that. I don't know if you can bear me saying this, but it was actually quite a seminal moment in our little dating scenario when we first started getting together. It's completely irrelevant to the story in many ways, but we went on a relatively cheap date to the British Museum, and you know, they've got the restaurant there.
Yeah.
And then I sort of got us to wander back past the Rosetta Stone,
right,
because I know the story about how it was found in Napoleon's forces. It's a key to understanding hieroglyphics. And so there's me, you know, trying to show off about the story of this stone, which is the key to us understanding Greek civilization.
Greek hieroglyphics and demotic.
Exactly. It's got three of the ancient languages, right, which means we were able to translate the ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics eventually. And she said, yeah, that's really interesting. It says...
Ooh.
And then she translated it, and my sort of pathetic attempt at showing off... Well, I was knocked to one side. I mean, it shows, apart from being impressed with future misses, it was also a great demonstration. The continuity of civilization that you have there, to be able to still read the ancient Greek from then is still unbelievable. Unbelievable place. Unbelievable civilization. And my preconceptions were not necessarily... Actually, they weren't so much changed or shattered. In some ways, they were reinforced,
right,
I would say. In some ways, they were exaggerated. So, with all due respect to proud, patriotic Greeks who may well be in this audience, and with the proviso and caveat that I really love the place and you, I found I already knew Greeks were very proud, very passionate.
Very vocal.
A very vocal, not entirely happy about outsiders having a view or a comment on how things have been going there recently. And my opinion on that was reinforced several hundred times.
Where did you go then? Give us a couple of high spots that we can expect from this show. The monasteries you went to.
Monasteries, yes. Well, we started down in the Dodecanese Islands.
Right.
We started on a tilet line called Seremos. Near Kalymnos. I don't know if anyone's been down there, but it's pretty slightly off the touristy bit trail. But we started with one of the Mediterranean's last sponge divers. So that was the disgusting looking thing in the video. Sponges, for goodness sake, made many of the Greek islands and the Greek islanders fabulously rich. An incredibly dangerous thing to do when they all discovered compressor diving in the 1800s. But some of them made fortunes. Overfishing, pollution, it's wiped out most of the sponges in the Mediterranean. We went down with one of the last sponge fishermen. Great character. I mean, we met several guys who had a whiff of the Shirley Valentine movie about them, really. I mean, I'm a proud Brit. You know, yeah. I don't go abroad to escape here. But I could quite happily have been born Greek. I think that's a hell of a blessing in life. What a place. What a people. So we, from the moment we started, really, I loved it. I loved them. I loved the place. It's a great place to live, retire. Yep. Yes, there are problems. Absolutely. We don't shy away from those. The highlight for me, I think if I had to pick out two, if I can be allowed.
Of course.
One would be Crete. Crete, right. I thought, was mind-blowing. I mean, not just for the landscape. But for the people as well. It taught me a lot, actually. It taught me a lot about the modern Greece, I think, as much as anything, because we went out there with a bear of a man who is in the video called Father Andreas. He's a village priest, but he's also a fully trained bodyguard and the president of
the
local gun club. Yeah, so he carries a Glock handgun, which is a sort of flashy one the cops here carry, and a captured German sidearm from the Second World War. And a big, manly man went up out camping with him and some shepherds, all of them obsessed with guns. Ludicrous numbers of unlicensed weapons in Crete. Why have they got them? Well, they love their guns. I think he said it's an almost sexual thing. They had this fascination and love of the weapon. But, you know, if we'd been invaded as many times as Crete has over the centuries and over the eons of time, then I think we probably would quite like to have a shotgun or two. Obviously, most recently, they were invaded by the Germans in the Second World War. The atrocities that were committed then and the suffering of the Greek people generally during the Second World War is, I think, something that we forget. Hundreds of thousands of Greeks starved during the occupation alone. That is going to colour your view of German demands for austerity now, okay? Right. And I had much more of an understanding and sympathy with them for that now. So Crete was amazing, beautiful, people incredible. If you go, for goodness sake, go to the village of Anoia in the middle of Crete. Probably some people here have been. Incredible history that you can uncover there and understand. And if I could have a number two.
Before you go to number two, can we stay on Crete for a second? Because I'm intrigued by this. I understand Cretans to be as proudly Cretan as they are as proudly Greek. Did you get that?
I think there's a lot of truth in that. Yes, right. Yes. I mean, you can't be an island people like that for as long as they have with it not seeping into your very DNA. I mean, I think village would come first,
right.
then the island, then
the nation.
Country, then the continent. It's not in many ways that dissimilar from here, except they have a much stronger sense of their culture and their identity than we do. It's a blessing to be born that, to be honest, Frank. I think anyway. I mean, I feel like I've lost so many different elements of what it is to be a Brit. I'm not sure many of us can really fully understand or explain that. The Greeks know, you know?
Yeah, they know, absolutely. So your second high spot?
Second high spot, literal high spot, the mountains in the north. I think we talked about this before you've been, haven't you?
Yeah.
So the Pindos Mountains in the north of Greece. Has anyone been to the Pindos Mountains? Oh my, one arm! My goodness, I'm amazed by that. A couple of arms.
Go ahead, sell us the Pindos Mountains.
Pindos Mountains.
Why should we
go?
Well,
they're like, my God, they're like the Canadian Rockies in the sunshine. So mountains up near Albania, covered in forests, great valleys and gorges. They've got one of the most spectacular sites in Europe in the north of Greece. Hardly anyone goes there. The Vikos Gorge, which is perhaps the deepest gorge in the world, depending who's doing the calculation. But it plummets down 1,600 feet, I think, down limestone cliffs. And you stand on the edge of it, no health and safety rail or anything boring like that. And you boom a hello out, as I did in the program, and it echoes around and the hairs on your arm go up and you think you've discovered a lost world. You have to go if you can. It's astonishing up there. But you know, too many people think of Greece just as the beach and the taverna. And I think they forget the mainland. Obviously, they think about Athens as well, but they forget the whole great north of Greece, which is absolutely stunning. Bears. They've got bears and wolves in northern Greece, for goodness sake. Great wilderness areas and wildlife as well. So I just remembered.
One of the things you're really good at, one of the things I really admire you for the shows that you make for, is that you seem to narrow the gap between you, the presenter, us, the audience, and the people that you're talking to. So while we're on Greece, let's discuss this a bit. You get to talk to the Greeks about how they feel about being Greek at the moment and what it means. And of course, as we said at the top, they're having a terrible financial time and they're confronting the front of, what was it, Cameron's swarm of migrants, but the people who are running away from war or financial disaster, whether from Syria and Afghanistan. What was the sense you got from them about how beleaguered they feel as Greeks at the moment? Did you go into that?
Yes, we did. It's several points there, actually, because it is interesting. I tried, don't let me forget the second bit, but I tried several times, actually, to ask people, what is it to be Greek now? And actually, it's quite a hard question for people to answer, and we didn't really get an answer that was translatable into the sort of short, pithy sentence that telly needs and requires,
right.
Because, you know, people will switch over to the other channel if it takes too long. And it was an interesting thing because, I think we've had this conversation before about the need sometimes for almost a fiction writer to translate a situation and a scenario that people who are in it can't necessarily fully vocalize. And I felt sometimes I really wanted to just say, look, I've been here long enough to take a view on what Greece is, but you can't really...
You don't have the right.
I don't entirely have the right. I mean, I took a bit of a liberty with it at some points and did say it, but we didn't get the pithiest of responses to that. In answer to the second point on the specifics, yes, people were very keen to tell us they felt abandoned by Europe when it came to the migrant and refugee crisis, and they felt overwhelmed by the influx. And I think both points were very fair and true, because on some of the islands, the number of people arriving is utterly extraordinary. Even now during the winter, it's really surprising to me to see how many are still coming. It's an absolutely extraordinary, mind-blowing situation. It may well lead to the collapse of Europe as we know it. in the sense of open borders and, oh, you know, let's all just go right. for increased economic growth. I think those sort of that sort of simplistic dream may take a bit of a knot from the politics of reality. And ever more so when the emerging billions in Africa suddenly realise that the gap isn't that big as well. You know, we are going to confront a lot of serious issues that on my journey it seemed I didn't think Europe was fully able to deal with. When I was on the... Lesbos, exactly, yeah. We were in Lesbos at the start of the summer just as the crisis really became a serious crisis. And there was really very little external presence, i.e. Greek officials, European officials. There was a point where I got the camera to swing round when there were just migrants and refugees arriving. There were literally two German holidaymakers in bikini and budgie smugglers, you know, tiny trunks, and us as a little foreign film crew, and hundreds of people arriving. And it was...
So we say hundreds of people, like, people coming off boats that they crossed the 3-4 miles from Turkey to come to...
Yeah. And nothing there to... I say it in the program, and I'm not sure how it will be received, because it's a very intensely complicated, difficult situation where views are often very polarized. But, you know, I was very surprised that there was nobody there to stop them or to look after them, to push them back, to welcome them, to do anything. There just wasn't. Europe hadn't geared up to respond to what was then already a huge number of people coming
so
in.
So they just get off the boats, they walk up the beach... And they're in Europe, that's it.
They are in Europe, yeah. They are in Europe, and then they had to walk 40 miles, I think, in many cases, in blazing heat to a registration point and to a place where they wanted to get boats to Athens and then onwards to Northern Europe.
Sweet mercy. Do you think we should still holiday in Greece? I mean, should Greece be supported by us going there and spending our tourist money? Do you have a view on the morality of this?
I think the morality there is much less complicated than it is in other parts of the world. You know, Greece has not been morally or immorally affected really by the situation. It hasn't responded as well as it probably should or could to the situation. But it is supposed to be part of a European bloc that is supposed to assist it in that situation. So nobody has responded adequately in any sense of keeping out or welcoming in, whatever your view is. That's my opinion. Should we go there? Absolutely. If you want to, definitely do. I would be probably more inclined to go there now because I find situations like that in their complexity more interesting. You know, you are not going to be confronted as a traveler by emaciated, starving children, quite frankly. Most of the people who are coming, the vast majority, are capable of affording $1,000 or $1,500 crossing to get there. So in many cases, it's the middle class and the well-educated who are coming. So if your fear is frightening the children, I don't think that will happen.
The sad truth is they're paying more to cross those 3 miles from Turkey than most of us will pay for a one-week package holiday in...
That is a really interesting point, and I regret not thinking of it before. It's a quite profound thought, actually. Yeah,
compare and contrast.
It's extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary. So, you're not going to be confronted by a horror. And absolutely, if you care about Greece and you care about the Greeks and you want to go somewhere lovely, of course you should go there, absolutely.
Can I be a bit personal with you? Because I don't know if this crowd know this about you, but most of the TV presenters that we see, we think they're Oxbridge educated, they've got mates at the BBC, they went to university together, and they're on a cushy number, travelling on a train around India or doing something, if you're Michael Portillo or Michael Palin, all of whom we love. But this guy, hopefully, he'll permit me to say, doesn't come from that. He was born up the road in Acton, didn't go to university, just happens to love travelling. How did you get started? How did you make that leap? Do you mind me being that person?
I don't mind.
A bit late if you don't.
I quite like the way you did it, actually. It was rather flattering, so thank you.
Well, there we go. Because you are the real deal. That's what I find fascinating about how you present. But give us an insight into how you got started.
I agree that there are too many... There's a few posh folk at the on telly, let's be honest. Yeah. I think the best way in, if anybody fancies it, the best way in is not to go my route, which was starting life on the dole and as a postboy then. That's not a sensible way. There's quite a few ex-army types who are telepresenters, but I think they've got a sort of skill set that transfers, or they've been plucked from doing something else.
You're talking about Bear Grylls and...
Well, there's quite a few of them. I mean, Leveson Wood, I think, is on the weekend, is ex-forces, and there's a number of others who are as well. I think that's a,
what was
that's
your
a more normal career path than mine. And mine was, as you say, be rather pathetic student, fail exams hopelessly due to substantial alcohol intake. And generally start life as failure. I don't know what sort of level of detail you want me to go into, how much you want me to sort of humiliate myself here.
No. When did you get your first break?
Well, first break, what was that? That was my dad spotting an advert in the Sunday Times newspaper for postboys. Why not? I think Andrew Neil, who you may well know, who was the editor of the Sunday Times at the time, he had gone down to the postroom in a bit of a huff because nobody was picking up the phone there. He needed a package sent. And he'd found a group of lads with their feet up on the desk smoking dope. And they had their employment had finished quite rapidly. And several other new posties were brought in, of which I was one. And that was a sort of start at 6 or 5 or some god-awful hour of the morning job, sort the post for hours and hours and hours. And then I stayed on and sort of offered up myself as, you know, a willing gopher and researcher. And I started photocopying newspaper cuttings for people there. And then I was allowed to go on little missions. And then by the time I was 18 or 19, I had a walkie-talkie and I was following an arms dealer from Gatwick Airport. I cannot tell you how much fun it was. It was so exciting. It was very boys-only. It was an era before risk assessments or anything like that. I remember tracking down a couple of South African neo-Nazi terrorists who were on the run in the UK. I went to meet them in Boston in Lincolnshire, and I was late to see them because I went to the post office to send my mum a card saying, "Mum, I'm out of London. It's very exciting." I don't come from a wealthy, travelly family. I didn't get on a plane until I started working. So travel has been a very exotic later experience in life for me.
Well, you say exotic experience. I've got a little list here of some of the exotic bits. Here we go. So this guy here, he's been arrested for spying by the KGB.
That wasn't very good.
Taught to fish by the president of Moldova.
That was fun.
Tracked by terrorists.
That's not good.
Electrocuted in a war zone. Protected by stone Somali mercenaries.
This will give me a bit of post-traumatic stress. You
he's
know.
Hunted with the bush of the Kalahari, this. Walked through minefields, witnessed trench warfare in the Caucasus. And holds an official Somali diplomatic passport.
I do actually. Yeah.
Tell us how you came by.
I'm quite proud of that. Yeah.
Tell us about Mr. Big Beard.
Oh, that's very well remembered. Very well remembered. Okay, so very serious place, obviously. Mogadishu in Somalia. This was a few years back. I was filming a series, one of the first ones I did. It was called Places That Don't Exist. And it was all about countries that aren't officially countries. Sorry for having my back to you, by the way. So you think you know planet Earth when you've got all those members of the United Nations in your head, but there are also several dozen other unrecognized countries or unrepresented people who haven't made it into the United Nations. And Somaliland in the Horn of Africa, has anyone been to Somaliland? Go on, go. There's some youngsters amongst us and some young at heart. Go to Somaliland. It's such an incredible place to go. One of my favorite places in the world. But to get there and to illustrate the normality and democracy of Somaliland, even though it doesn't appear on a map and the British government won't recognize it, we went to Mogadishu in Somalia, which was still at the time very much of the Black Hawk Down chaotic warlord era in its history. And to sort of illustrate that, we went to the market in Mogadishu. And as you alluded to, I was being protected, myself and two colleagues, by about a dozen rather stoned local mercenaries. And I bought a Somali diplomatic passport from a bloke called Mr. Big Beard for $75, I think, with my own photograph and name in. And it was the official passport. He'd nicked them all this stack of passports from the passport ministry. And if you wanted a Somali passport at the time, you had to go and see Mr. Big Beard. absolutely surreal, but an illustration of the chaos of the place and the sort of suffering, really, I suppose, that people were enduring there. And it was really bad at the time. It was a horrendous place to go to.